Okay. So welcome back, everyone. I hope Christmas went well for you Christmas celebrators. I hope Santa Claus brought you everything you wished for. Tomorrow, I think tomorrow evening is New Year's Eve, so I hope everyone stays happy and safe on New Year's. Last week we started chatting about kind of the nature of suffering, really, and I felt a certain kind of obligation to give you the sort of, I guess, tantric perspective on suffering and how it relates to fire, how it relates to Agni, and how it relates to Udhyana Bandha. I was planning on hoping to give a few, a sort of step-by-step practice of some ways that we can do Udhyana Bandha. But I realized, you know, most of us have probably done that together before. I think most of you are familiar with the basics of how we can play with Udhyana Bandha. But if you're not, feel free to just send me a message and let me know kind of what you're unclear on, or if you'd still like to have a practice like that, because we can find a time for it. Tonight, what I'd really like to sort of shine our attention on is perhaps a more sort of philosophical approach to suffering. And this kind of question that we started asking ourselves last week really came down to the question of how we can evolve, how we can grow without hardening our hearts, right? Without armoring our hearts. And we had a few stories from me and others about kind of the risk there, you know, the danger of so-called learning our lessons and yet doing so without building up a sort of a wall, right? And perhaps I should say at the outset, as we kind of start to look at these questions, and realistically I could probably say it at the outset of every talk we have together, that while our vehicle here is words, you know, in this kind of internet age we're having these talks online each week, you know, in a way I don't really believe anything I say, because the nature of this work of yoga and love and awakening and the divine, you know, it's concerning the spaces between the words rather than the words themselves. So, I mean, we're dealing with a realm of human existence here that's basically not conceptual. And we're faced with the predicament of trying to convey the non-conceptual realm through concepts, through words. So it's kind of like, you know, I have to kind of ask everyone at the outset to just take everything you hear with a grain of salt. You know, if you don't like these words, don't worry about them. They're going to pass quickly, you know, like Chinese food, and you'll have forgotten about them in just a few hours. So, I hope that helps. In order to understand suffering, and ultimately to understand the stages of life and the process of the end of life, we have to have a context in which to understand this kind of stuff. So the context is, you know, what is the meaning of it? What am I doing here on Earth? Right? Because if we have an idea about our purpose, we can have an idea if a process of transformation is functional or dysfunctional, whether it's useful or not. Because as we were saying last week, you know, none of us here are so kind of naive to think that only that which gives us pleasure is useful, right? Most of you have found through your own experiences that there's incredible growth in suffering. It doesn't mean that we go around programming suffering into people's lives. We don't give suffering 101. But when we look back at our lives, we see that some of the most profound changes occur in the moments of the most extreme suffering. And we see that the nature of the suffering is that we're confronting a situation which is somehow not in line with the model that we have of how reality ought to be, And really, that's the ultimate cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is this place in your mind that's defining how you think something ought to be. So if you think things ought to be a certain way and they're not, then there's a discomfort and you suffer. And a lot of what our suffering has been is not due to the actual characteristics of the situation, but due to the way in which we perceive, the way that we observe the situation. So that perception is based upon our kind of contextual understanding of who we are and what we're doing here. So, in a sense, in order to take this a step further, we kind of have to delve deeper into the sort of philosophical underpinnings of all this stuff. Because, you know, you could say that the tantric path or the hatha yogi's path is ultimately sort of metaphorical, right? The tantric yogi looks for ways to model the experience in the body on the external world, right? To sort of unite the organism and the environment through movement, through energy, through visualization, and in so doing, kind of create a change that's lasting, right? But there's sort of another way that we can look at this whole thing, and that's simply through myth, through story, through image, and that's what I'd like to try to do tonight. You know, we talked briefly last week about moments in our lives or moments in my life where we've seen how kind of belief systems can be so strong, right, that they can kind of take a sad tune and make them a happy tune, right? Can change the entire meaning of a situation. You know, in parts of India there are many, many beings that make maybe just 20 or 30 rupees a day, right? This is less than a single American dollar. And they're living under bridges or on the sidewalk and really just scraping by with the most minimal amount of food and shelter and clothing you could imagine. But what's strange is that sometimes when I look in these people's eyes, I can experience a kind of quality of their being that seems more in tune or more in harmony with the universe than I'll often find in the face of someone who is successful, you know, affluent, everything we sort of value in the West. And once I get over my kind of arrogance, my ethnocentric sort of arrogance about the whole thing that so many Westerns have, that we're the most successful and most advanced and most happy culture, right? Surely you've all read the studies that have been made about how the United States is like one of the least happy countries on Earth, which is pretty funny actually, because there's definitely a I don't know, there seems to be a sort of a strange theme that's sort of taught to children in the States, and maybe this is the same no matter what country you're in, but we kind of all growing up thinking that we kind of have it right, don't we? We kind of, Americans anyway, really grew up thinking like, oh, we've got this freedom and we can do whatever we want and we can practice whatever religion and we can get rich if we want to get rich, and we can overwhelm class change, and somehow this leap in the mind is made to where we think that we're happy. We think that as a culture we're happy, which, you know, if you've looked at the data, it's just preposterous. We're actually one of the least happy cultures on Earth. So if we can get over that kind of arrogance for a moment, you know. I remember this this great bumper sticker that I had on my bicycle maybe 20 years ago, but it was from the Lonely Planet company, the company that makes all these great guidebooks for travelers, and the Lonely Planet bumper sticker said, "Do something great for your country, leave, right? Suggesting that we can only kind of learn about our culture's sort of strengths and weaknesses if we go and see it through the lens of other cultures, right? So anyway, if we can get over that arrogance for a moment, we have a great deal to learn about the dignity of the processes of life, right, and death, and the way of kind of understanding them in a way to release us rather than to chase us, to torment us. So to kind of show you maybe a bit of how this kind of has grown and changed in me over the last, 15 years or so, I'm just going to digress a little. You know, I grew up in a house full of boys, three older brothers, and in this house, you know, your kind of worth was measured in your athletic performance, more or less. Academic also was important, I guess, to my folks, but among my kind of closest role models, sports were kind of everything. So I tried sport after sport, sort of failing to excel in each one, until I found one that actually seemed like it had more to do with the effort you put in versus the skill you brought. And when I found it, I gave everything to it. I invested all of my physical energy, all of my mental thought, all of my emotion into that life. I mean, even my diet for a teenager was kind of obsessively strict. I didn't know anybody else that was keeping such a careful eye on every calorie and trying to get maximum nutrition for it for performance. And so I continued this life to compete through university levels and continue to kind of play that game, and by game I don't mean the sports game, but this kind of this image of this experience of trying to live my life out as hard as I knew how, right? To kind of give everything, to throw everything onto the table, to collect all the points I knew how to collect, right? And even as I continued to do this, I had this kind of uneasiness, this growing uneasiness within me that I was missing something, right? Like a malaise. And when we experience a malaise, we tend to treat it as if it's our fault, as if it's our neurosis or it's our lack of adaptability to the existing culture, which kind of must be right, of course, right? Because there's so many of them and I feel so different from all of them. So because there's so many of them, they must be right and I'm obviously wrong, right? And so I kept trying to readapt my being to fit into the patterns this culture was giving me. And it just wasn't working. So in the end, I decided to retire from wrestling about halfway through university to try to find some fulfillment to give me a feeling of well-being, right? Because wrestling wasn't doing that for me. And that brought me into traveling the world and eventually for some good long years into a period of experimenting with psychotropic substances, with chemicals that alter consciousness. And that definitely changed my head around quite a bit. I started to realize that my malaise, my discomfort, wasn't just my pathology, but it was a deeper something in me trying to awaken. And instead of seeing it as a sickness, as a problem, I could see it as something kind of graceful that was trying to awaken, to be honored. And maybe it'd be useful to allow my life to adapt, to tune to those feelings of wrongness and rightness. And I tried that. I tried just allowing my life to kind of take the course it would naturally take to respond to this intuitive sense of, you know, right, okay, this is all right. And that took me kind of away from my sort of obsession with athletics, and it took me into psychedelics, it took me into yoga, it took me to India, it took me all over Asia, and took me to a sort of different way of seeing the world. And what I found, much to my surprise, was that whatever happened to me in those years had kind of totally changed my feelings about death. And as a result, they were changing my feelings about life. It was like it was changing who I thought I was. So instead of walking you through that process, I'm going to try to just do this in a really kind of blunt way. I'm just going to tell you kind of how I see the world. And many of you will hear it and say, well, that's rot. That's useless, right? It doesn't make any sense. And that's totally okay. You have total license to reject it, to find it totally useless, really. But anything less than that would be dishonest on my part. So I'm just gonna go for broke. And you know, if I was to be totally frank about it, right? I could be even more outrageous, and I could say that what I'm going to say isn't just a belief system, right? It's the way things are. So you see, when somebody says something like that, right, the your shackles go up, right? But what can I do, right? I it's like I just have to sort of play along. I have to give this a shot, right? So let's see where it goes. To the extent that I'm anything at all, right? That I'm anything manifest, we could say that I'm a separate entity, right? Like a set of characteristics. So a program that's manifesting by taking a human birth. So it's like I've taken a birth into a body, and that body has with it a personality. Or you could go the other way, right? I've taken a birth into a personality, and that personality is within a body. And I'm going through a set of experiences, which is called living life. And these experiences have a certain function for me. These experiences, if they're used consciously, if they're used intentionally by me, are vehicles through which I can awaken to who I am. So I'll take you through this through an example. Some of you may have heard this before. So you imagine that you have next to your eyes a little control switch, a little dial. And you you look at another human being, like on channel 1, right? And what you see when you look at another human being is you see a physical body, right? You see a woman, you see a man, you see old, you see young, you see fat, thin, ugly, handsome. You know, if you're a scientist, you see mesomorphs, endomorphs, ectomorphs. But it's this matrix of individual differences on a physical plane. Okay? So that's the plane of standing on the corner and watching all the girls go by. Well, I guess for most of you, it's standing on the corner and watching all the boys go by. Right? That reality. So now let's just say you're looking at another person, right? And you flick this little die. This little dial next to your eyes. You kind of flick the receiver one channel. Now you're on channel 2. So now, when you look at another person, you see something different. What you see now is you see their psychology, right? Oh, you're a manic depressive. Oh, you're a happy person. And I wish I was happy like you. You know, people in psychotherapy live on this channel usually, right? They're totally preoccupied with their fears, their depressions, their elations, their loneliness, their hopes, their fears, right? And that's their reality, right? Like, that's the real you. And the physical body is just the carrier of that psychology. But what, let's say we flip it again. Let's say we flip that receiver again. So you turn this little dial, and you look at another person. And if you're so trained, you'd look at this person and say, "Oh, I know who you are. You're a Libra, right? I can tell because of the way you handled that decision." Or, "Oh, you're an Aries. You were born on such and such a date," right? And on this channel, there are only 12 beings in the universe and various permutations of them, right? So you're now seeing what could be known as the kind of astral identity of a person. You're seeing another plane, another reality of this person. So these are three ways, there are three sort of matrices of looking at individual differences, this physical plane, this psychological plane, and the astral plane. But what if you flipped it again, right? What if you reach up and you turn your little dial and you look into another person's eyes? What you see is another being looking back at you. Like inside an astral configuration, inside a psychological configuration, inside a body. And it's like, "Are you in there? Like, I'm in here. How did you get into that one?" And you could see what the Christians would call soul, right? You see another being, another soul, just like you. No different, right? Just like you, just another being. And you see that all the other differences are just the stuff in which this being is encased. Now you could almost be comfortable with that one, right? But unfortunately, we've got to keep flicking the dial a few more times. So you flick the dial again, right? And you look into someone's eyes, and what you see is yourself looking at yourself, looking at yourself. Because, you know, on that plane, there's only one of it. It's like one awareness in all these forms, in a multiplicity of forms, just one awareness observing itself. And then finally, if you would dare to flick the dial just one more time, like if you haven't given up completely yet, you flick the dial just once more, and you disappear, and I disappear, and the dial disappears, and we're dealing with what the Buddhists call void, or the Christians might call before the word, right? Before the vibratory uniqueness. Kind of why God isn't able to even be spelled in the Hebrew religion. So the question becomes, of all these channels, who are you?